Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Rule of Three, a podcast about comedy. I'm Jason Hazley.
And I'm Joel Morris.
And as usual, we're joined by someone who makes comedy to talk about something funny that they love. By taking it apart, maybe we'll learn something about how comedy works. Or we'll just quote bits from it and giggle until we're finished. Both approaches are valid. Our special guest today is the writer, actor, comedian, bon vivant and boulevardier, Jean-Luc Roberts.
Well, yes, I suppose. Bon vivant, I mean, yeah, it depends what sort of day you catch me on. If I'm bon, I'm bon. If I'm not bon...
Can you be a mal vivant as well?
I guess that's my autumn style. Yeah. Mal vivant.
Sounds like an excellent sort of aftershave or something, doesn't it, really? Mal vivant.
Yeah, with that Johnny Depp's face just behind it, glowering.
Live the bad life.
Hey, you had a good Edinburgh, didn't you?
It went very well. It was a real delight, really.
Are you bringing it in, as the theatrical community says?
When does this go out?
Good question. Well, it's going out. It's going out exactly now,
right,
listener.
Yes.
The time you're hearing it. Welcome to Thursday
Soho
morning
theatre with my show. All I want to do is FX gunshots with an FX gun reloading and an FX cash register and perform some comedy from the 10th to the 15th of December, and then I'm taking it on national tour in the new year.
Fantastic. Brilliant. You're not known for easy show titles, are you?
Well, I decided to make it my thing. My general rule is, if I come up with an idea and I think, oh, you can't do that, then it's probably quite a good idea. No, yeah. That's not what titles look like.
But you're working in a field of absurdism, so yeah. if you start with a title, people can't say they weren't warned.
Well, that's another big part of it. You want to put off the people who won't like it as much as you're trying to get in the people who will.
If you call it, like, the giggle show, people might throw things.
Yeah.
One of the most exciting things watching you develop as a performer, I remember working with you as a writer and sort of seeing you with your early shows and things, is you moved from being very... I'm about to say cerebral, very, very verbal. And then you've just gone further and further into something very, very physical, very challenging, involving clowning and very, very personal. And every single move appears to have satisfied you more and brought the shows more...
He's frowning, listeners.
No, I know,
he's frowning.
I'm thinking it. Yeah, I started as a very... I'd stand on stage, my performance certainly, very dryly, generally doing one-liners. I think I got to the point of thinking, well, you should be able to prove this. A sort of safety mechanism that... A one-liner, of course, is the one joke it's the closest I think you can get to an equation with writing.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's not necessarily funny, but you can definitely go, well, it's definitely a joke.
You
see
provable.
How it adds up,
yeah.
And you can prove it like that.
Yeah.
And then I thought the performance wasn't important. And then as time went by, I realised everything I enjoyed about watching comedy and enjoying comedy was people just being stupid. And doing clowning let me realise, oh, you're allowed to just have fun. It's allowed to be fun.
Yeah.
You don't have to sort of prove everything. And so the way I look at it now really is that having fun and being stupid is... what people like, and the jokes are sort of the icing on the cake. But that's because I came to it through joke writing. I think of writing as the least important thing to
It's a very unusual route, because normally if you start off as someone who regards... When you used to... I remember going to see one of your first shows and you had the jokes pre-prepared on cards and then delivered them as insults to the audience, showing the mechanism of a stand-up, saying, these are pre-prepared insults. I've not... Like people might have for a heckler. They're pre-prepared insults, which you then applied to people. It was a very cerebral game of playing, you know this is written. It's very rare for someone to go beyond that, because if I'd thought of that idea, I'd have stuck with it for my career. And what's amazing is you went, actually, this isn't enough. It's really admirable to take something you're really good at and then go beyond it into something which must have been frightening at first.
Yeah, I suppose so. Well, thank you for saying that. The insults was an interesting one, because I started doing that as myself when I was 20-year-old, middle-class white man, and audiences would generally get riled. But men especially, sort of beta males in the audience, sometimes got angry and really? I would be scared after the gig. Yeah, because this pretending to be insulting, while... constantly undermining it. I mean, by saying, this is just in order, this isn't personal, but I'd need to lower your self-confidence so you laugh a bit more. But some of them would not kind of, would miss the joke of it. But then I started, I did a show playing a kind of clown version of my father after he died. I played him sort of as I saw him when I was 5 years old, as this huge, terrifying creature. And so I stuffed a suit with balloons, was in this massive thing, big fake beard. And then the insults started working much better from him, because already it was being undermined. The audience knew what the game was, because I looked so stupid.
You're a pompous idiot, so I can take it from you.
Yeah, and you're not a sort of... If you're just a smartly dressed man, you really need some way of undermining it. You need something else, because it's not fun, it's just smug, I think.
So that's why jesters wore their silly striped clothes, presumably, because actually you've got to put yourself at one remove from the person you are in order for the being insulting to someone's face to be funnier.
Yeah, I think that's true. Unless, I mean, you sort of bring privilege and intersectionality into it, I guess. If you're a white man and you're at the top of the tree,
you're punching down.
Then that doesn't work. If you're an outcast from society, one way, and you're a buffoon or something, then you can do that. You can come and do it, but otherwise you have to find some way of...
Well, you play tricks with it. I mean, it's really noticeable that one admires the other, but the way that Stuart Lee, who's a huge admirer of Alexei Sayle, worked out if he was going to wear a suit on stage, it was better if he was a bit overweight and the suit was a size too small.
Yeah, yeah.
And that is Laurel and Hardy. That's dressing as tramps. That's Chaplin. That's saying, I'm wearing a suit, but I'm W.C. Fields and I've punched out the top of my hat and I look like a hobo. Mm. And you immediately go, okay, that's now taking the sting out.
Yeah, and also Stuart Lee's stand-up act, was a lot better when he was older.
Yeah.
When he was, you know, slim, cool, handsome, young Stuart Lee, people didn't quite like it so much. He got older and suddenly it worked because he looked like he... It was the Sadowitz thing. You sort of let Sadowitz get away with it because he's completely not aspirational.
Yeah.
You watch Sadowitz and don't go, oh, I want to be that smartly dressed man being horrible at everyone. You go, oh my God, I don't want to end up like that.
Well, isn't the arrogant clown, then, when you've studied clowning a lot more than me, which is more than none. Your aspirational clown, your vain clown, your Ted in the Father Ted thing, the guy, the pompous guy in the middle, is usually a sort of aspirational middle-class father figure. But he's immediately stupid. There's a link there with that sort of pompous authority figure who's telling you off to something like the League Against Tedium.
I saw the League Against Tedium when I was 15. Simon Munnery on top of a bus, driving into a smoke-filled tent on the Meadows, I think, in Edinburgh, while Attention Scum was projected on a screen behind him on the bus because there was a ship on the top of the bus. And he was wearing this huge top hat and his hand... He was wearing a glove made of dildos. And I think his opening line was, come on, I'll take you all on. While, you know, this is blaring out, Attention Scum, you are nothing, you are worthless. And then all these jokes come out. And I thought it was amazing. And that actually led me into trying to... I thought I could do that until... It was years later, I realized, Simon Munnery is a small man wearing a huge thing. Already he is a low-status figure on stage, delicate little, fragile being. But he looked like somebody in clothes that weren't his, and he was pretending to be massive and powerful.
There was a Wizard of Oz thing going on.
A huge, intimidating figure without all this stuff.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have been funny.
The size of the hat, I thought, was brilliant.
Yeah.
It was exactly too tall.
Exactly too tall. And then he had that little tube so he could blow in it and the hat would... lengthen.
So, Luke, just can we just do your name for a minute here?
Oh, yeah.
Because this is such a good anecdote.
Is it? Well,
I think so.
So my name's John Luke Roberts.
Luke's your middle name?
Luke's my middle name.
It's not like a Star Trek captain. It's not John Luke.
No, it's not Jean-Luc. Although in France, they do get confused and assume I'm French until I try to speak French, and then they know. Anyway, I was called Luke through my childhood. I was referred to as Luke. Then I was going to be Luke Roberts. There was already on Spotlight, the casting website, a Luke Roberts, who I believe was in Holby City. So I was going to be Lucas Roberts, I think, which then by the time I went to take it, to register it, was taken. I think I dodged a bullet there. But then I tried to be John Luke Roberts, but there was a John Roberts as well. So they wouldn't let me be John Luke Roberts without a hyphen between John and Luke. So I ended up as John Luke Roberts, and that's now my name. But then a few years later, I went to sign up to Equity, and they wouldn't let me be John Luke Roberts because I think they had different rules on the doubling of the names, or their computer system just wouldn't let it. So on Equity, I'm John Luke hyphen Roberts.
It's just too complicated.
It's a bit much. I was saying to them, you're meant to be my union.
You're
meant to be helping me. This is my professional name. It's on Spotlight. This is what I'm cast as. Yes, we know.
You're even filling this form out is now really difficult. I can't even start.
You're the only person I know who has a floating hyphen there.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where it goes. I might try and get it in between some letters sometime.
Yeah, why not?
John Luke Roe hyphen Burt, as if you're a robot.
Yeah. I could hyphenate every single letter. Yeah. Have a big articulated name. That I can whip people with. Like a beer snake.
I reckon for next year's Edinburgh, not only an unwieldy title, but an unwieldy name.
Yes, that's
the
what I need to do.
Perfect twofer.
By the way, the song that your show is named after, I love that song, and I can't work out whether I'm supposed to. Well, whether I'm allowed to, sorry.
Mm.
I'm sort of going, is this a song? Does it glorify violence? I don't think it does.
Oh, no, no. It's about, it's basically an anti, it's an anti-immigration song. Effectively.
Oh, okay.
But although it's also, I don't think most people, I certainly don't use it that way in my show. It's just a song which has a lot of sound effects in and is an awful lot of fun.
Yes, it is. A ton of fun. Yeah. Talking of fun and songs.
Well, this also links up to your idea of jokes as a formula. We're going to do probably the foremost musical mathematician of song.
Yes.
We're talking about Tom Lehrer.
Tom Lehrer, yeah. You didn't even need to qualify it that much, I think. No. The mathematics is almost incidental.
Right.
That's how
like
good a mathematical comedy musician he is.
You can't even see the formulas.
No.
Now instead of 4 in the tens place, you've got 3 because you added 1, that is to say 10 to the 2, but you can't take 7 from 3, so you look in the hundreds place. From the 3, you then use 1 to make 10 ones, and you know why 4 plus minus 1 plus 10 is 14 minus 1, because addition is commutative, right? And so you got 13 tens, and you take away 7, and that leaves 5. Well, 6, actually, but... the idea is the important thing.
So what drew you to Tom Lehrer, or was Tom Lehrer forced upon you?
I think it was forced upon me. Increasingly these days, you know, you sort of do publicity for whatever little tour you're doing or show, and they ask you, hey, what are your influences? And then I realised I was just listing the same ones. And every now and then I stumbled upon something and go, hang on, I spent years listening to this and completely forgot about it in my childhood. Oh, I watched that every Friday night and I've completely forgotten how much that influenced me. I was reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy the other day for the first time in years. I went, oh God, I just stole your way of, oh no. interestingly, you know the well thing in the beginning of scripts?
Yeah.
The writing, well, at the beginning of a line, and how I think John Finnemore does a well edit where he'll go through a script to remove all the wells.
What you can do, you can lose a page of a script. Yeah. If your script's running 31 pages and they want 30, take the wells out.
I think it originates with Adams. Yeah, if you read... the novelization of Hitchhiker's Guide, there's so many wells at the beginning of lines. So many characters start saying, well, comma, I think that might be where it comes from.
It's a pause for thought.
It's a beat for laughter, isn't it?
Yeah. But actually, I suppose what you're talking about there as well, what is really weird when someone tells you that, I mean, Finnemore told me this, so take out the O's and the wells. Andrew Ellard told me that as well. So take out the O's and the wells, the actors will put them in when they need them. And I just screamed, no, but that's the rhythm. And it's because you are always working in your head to a rhythm when you're writing comedy, because you want to make sure that the jokes fall on the strong beats or don't fall on the strong beats. Mm-hmm. There's always a metronome going in your head. And sometimes well is your opening... Is the one of the 1, 2, 3, 4.
And I think it's also an arrow almost. The well means well, and that's shorthand somehow for, oh, this bit's the punchline. Well, this bit's the joke. It highlights that it's there somehow.
Yeah,
there's a sense of rhythm in all comedy. And I think this is why comedy music has to be done really well, because all comedy has got music in it.
Yeah, so back to Tom Lehrer, I guess. I realise how much I think it was my father put it, like, we listened to it a lot, Car Journeys, it was always there. Yep. I can't find all the songs anymore. I think Spotify is missing some of the, that was the week that was ones, which is quite...
Well, he claims,
oh, that, and that's a very fine album, isn't
it? Yes.
My word.
The numbers on this, I've read that he'd written 50 songs over 30 years or something,
yep. mm-hmm.
and he then claims 37. Which is a very Tom Lehrer thing to do. That when someone says, you've written 50 songs, you go, no, I haven't. I did less than that. And it's that sort of very, very light under a bushel thing that's sort of...
I'm so drawn to the... I think, you know, as a performer, I think especially, you have such ego problems. The whole need to go on stage and do things in front of an audience, be laughed at, to get validation or whatever, feel good. It's a bit... pitiful, isn't it? And so when you see these performers who just go, I'm stopping now, this doesn't matter to me that much, this isn't what I need to survive in this world, you go, oh my god, I wish I was like you. Like Jasper Carrot, weirdly, a similar sort of figure, of never did comedy because he had to, just left.
Well, he made loads of money. Jasper Carrot, this is a brilliant fact, Jasper Carrot owned the Quantel machine, the digital video manipulation machine that was used on Top of the Pops to turn 10cc into a wine glass and spin it up in the distance. And he owned that, and he used to license it to the BBC. And that is the company that then became Celador, that then owned Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So he was a very successful businessman for a while. But he did it by buying the Kenny Everett video squashing machine. Tom Lehrer, of course, notoriously retired because he said satire was dead. The quote was always, oh, because Henry Kissinger had been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, brilliantly, very Tom Lehrer, he denied that was the reason. And you're thinking, that's a really good joke. Someone else would stick with that.
One of the great things about Lehrer is how contradictory he is. For instance, he's still with us. He is 90.
Yeah.
But he encourages rumours of his death. and yet, even while he encourages rumours of his death, he's in the Santa Cruz fucking phone directory.
Really?
You can ring him up.
We should bring him up now.
Yeah, he retired from performing, didn't he? He's talked about that quite a lot since, actually, which is very interesting. He said, I found I didn't need anonymous appreciation.
God.
That's how he described being in front of an audience.
Yep.
And he said that he'd done a couple of shows later in his career where he had started with the second verse of a tune instead of the first, and then said to the audience, oh, sorry, I've started in the wrong place, I'll go back and start again. And then started again and then thought... And then stopped and said to the audience, look, you know the song, let's just get on to the next one. And then he thought, my heart wasn't in it anymore.
Yeah.
I was starting to just do it on autopilot.
It's interesting talking about this with Lehrer, actually, because he is one of the best listeners to an audience around. You hear it on all his live albums. The way he plays those laughs, the way he will stop, start again, the way a laugh will get a second laugh and he'll know. And obviously, he's listening so intently, talking really in the bits bridging the songs, where he's listening so much that he can do that, play them, listen, be there with them. That to also have that mind and the mind that can construct a song to basically go, well, the laughs have to go here, here, this is where they're going to laugh, to predict the point they're laughing, which is the trick, I suppose, of those, you know, you're putting together a framework and you have to kind of know where the laughs go.
I've never quibbled if it was ribald. I would devour where others merely nibbled. As the judge remarked the day that he acquitted my Aunt Hortense, to be smut it must be utterly without redeeming social importance. Pornographic pictures I adore, indecent magazines galore. I like them more if they're hardcore.
And of course there's something with comedy songs where it's not quite so important how much people laugh during the song, as long as there's a big applause and clap at the end. But he still has so many laughs through these places. He knows where to put the punchlines to have room for this laugh to register without the audience worrying about cutting off the beginning of the next joke.
I've never thought about that. It's something that Stan Laurel said. There's a very sad story about Stan Laurel towards the end of his life, and he was watching when they repeat Stan and Ollie, Laurel and Hardy movies on the telly. And he'd watch them, and he'd watch them quite sadly, and his wife would come in and say, are you not enjoying this? And he said, they're so slow. We left space for them to stop laughing, and I'm sitting in this room on my own, and all I can do is hear the silence. And if you're that astonishing, and they were musicians of joke, they knew when to leave the gaps. And it never occurred to me, when you're running a song, it's running in 3-4, and there's or 4-4, and there's a rhythm going, you can't stop the song for the laugh. The next line's coming up when the piano reaches that bit, and yet he's left a space for them.
Yeah, and sometimes he does, like in Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, when he first drops that line at the beginning of the first chorus, which is so unexpected and nothing like the lovely pastoral scene that he's been painting in the in the little verse lead up to it. Because it's such a big laugh, he's got a vamp for about 4 bars that he can just keep doing before he goes into the next line of the chorus.
To let
the
it
songs
land.
Are built to let the laughs land.
All the world seems in tune on a spring afternoon when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Every Sunday you'll see my sweetheart and me as we poison the pigeons in the park.
And then sometimes those vamps become the Oedipus Rex. The funniest bit in Oedipus Rex is probably just when he slips into that which is using to that in the other song, because this is where. But then suddenly, oh, that's the joke, that this is an appropriate bit of music for this topic.
From the Bible to the popular song, there's one theme that we find right along. Of all ideals they hail as good, the most sublime is motherhood. There was a man, though, who it seems once carried this ideal to extremes. He loved his mother and she loved him, and yet his story is rather grim.
And there's the opposite of that as well. So in, I think, which is my favourite song of his, National Brotherhood Week, which is the first one that he performed on, that was the week that was.
Yeah. This is the American version of that was the week that
was. Yeah, the American version. Yeah, he'd been sending in songs. He'd been sending in the lead sheets of the songs, and he found that, he said, the performers weren't getting it. They weren't getting the laughs. So I started to send him recordings of the songs, and that's when they said, why don't you come and do them? So National Brotherhood Week, he's got the religion verse in that, which has got that incredibly shocking punchline, and he just absolutely motors on over the laugh.
Oh, the Protestants hate the Catholics, and the Catholics hate the Protestants, and the Hindus hate the Muslims, and everybody hates the Jews, but during National Brotherhood Week...
Harry's on singing the chorus. He won't let the audience have that moment, because he knows that was an inflammatory laugh. Let's keep moving.
Well, he's really brilliant. Good. He's incredibly genteel and polite. He's doing piano music. He's doing the kind of music you might hear if you were in a bar and there'd be a guy singing in there. And there's a sophistication to that. He's not on stage with a guitar. He's not a folk singer. He's that guy. And yet he's busting taboos. Mm-hmm. And what he's playing with is the audience's sharp intake of breath on taboos. There's a brilliant New York Times quote, which is, Mr. Lehrer's muse is not fettered by such inhibiting factors as taste.
he reads that out in one of the albums, too.
And he says, this is exactly what I want. And there's that revolutionary excitement of saying, what if we're not careful? Yeah. What if I'm careful about everything except offending you? What if I'm careful about the music and the words? So you can't say I've been sloppy. I'm not just going up, running up on stage and shouting, knickers. I have deliberately chosen to offend you, and someone will be offended, and I'm playing with that as a notion. That puts him in the same category as George Carlin and Lenny Bruce and those people who are breaking taboos, but you can't say they're dumb.
Well, and it makes you trust that if you are offended, that there's something to it you're not getting.
Yes.
It makes you trust that there's a point to it, and it makes you look for the satirical point or the, you know, whatever it is that's behind the thing.
Well, but he said one of the things that he wanted to do with laughter, which I think is, I hadn't thought this before, and it's so true. I didn't realise he'd said this. He said there's a tribal element to it, that when someone breaks a taboo and says something about the Catholic Church or racism or something, he says, it's not going to convert anybody. You're always titillating the converted. You're not going to make someone go, oh, I was in favour of war and now I'm against it. But what you do is, if there's a laugh in a room to a taboo subject being broken, someone in that room who thought, maybe I'm not allowed to laugh at this, will go, well, everyone else is laughing. The expression of laughter at an idea gives people confidence that they're not alone. It's an incredibly powerful use of laughter. And Lehrer said that was his aim, was to make a room full of people laugh at a taboo idea so they wouldn't feel that they couldn't have that taboo idea again.
There's a great, he even justifies that with offence. There's a great thing in the liner notes for the 3-disc Tom Lehrer, The Remains of Tom Lehrer, that you can get, highly recommended. And he says, if after hearing my songs, just one human being is inspired to say something nasty to a friend or perhaps strike a loved one, it will all have been worth the while.
Is he just playing with... one of the things that's fun about it, again, it's sophistication. There's a sophisticated veneer to these. He's a trained musician. He's a clever man. And he's not being careful. The combination of sophistication and crudity is, I think, where a lot of the dynamite is in Tom Lehrer.
I'm not quite sure. I spend a lot of time thinking about offence in comedy and sort of good offence and bad offence and the things that I condone and the things that I don't. And obviously you have to make your own rules and you have to sort of understand these. It's odd having been brought up with Tom Lehrer's offensiveness. because it sort of feels the right kind, just because it's always been there in the background. And it's hard to listen to the songs and think there was a point when these were genuinely shocking, although, of course, it's still there.
Yeah.
But there's not an unkindness to it, oddly. I think that's
a very good point.
Yeah.
There's no... It's almost a cheerful nihilism.
Yeah. We'll all go together when we go.
Yeah.
That's which the is defining
a,
song.
Which is almost not... it's such a beautiful song. Like, the bit in that... The bit when it does go off into this rhyme, go to your respective Valhallas, do not pass go, do not collect $200.
Yeah.
It's funny, but almost I go, I wish that wasn't in it, because this is a... it's almost better than a comic song. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And you almost don't want the bit when you're allowed to laugh, because yeah. you're just... What a great...
Yeah, it's like Randy Newman's Drop the Big One, isn't it?
For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. Oh, what a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow.
Can we talk about his rhymes, by the way? Because fucking hell.
I know.
Man, can he do it.
I remember...
First of all, he can do it. Secondly, he doesn't give a shit when he overdoes it as well. When he rhymes funeral with sooneral.
Yeah.
And there's... what's the other great one? In I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, he rhymes Yom Kippur with Mississippi. You know?
He's got that loving way of going, he doesn't have to bother to do it.
Yeah. I'm not going to bother, and you're going to spot that I haven't bothered. Well, I've really bothered to not bother.
The end of the Elements song, where he stretches it, many more have not been discovered, rhyming discovered and Harvard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you go, that's a push. But you know that he's not made him, again, it's not a mistake. Mm-hmm. He's stretched the pronunciation there because you should enjoy the process along with him. There's a lovely thing. I mean, he's a mathematician. He's a trained mathematician. And he's fitting this thing together like... I wrote a little note saying this is a crossword, and then read a quote from him where he compared it similarly, saying there's a problem that needs to be solved in lyrics, that they have to fit in certain places, and you have to balance. It's like balancing an equation. One side of it has to balance the other side. Mm-hmm. You can see he's got the brain that can do that. He said himself, the precision is the same that's involved in maths as in lyrics, because he's fitting things and making them rhyme. Every song's... It's almost like the letters in Scrabble. They've got a numerical value. Mm-hmm. And one of these words adds up to 15, so you need another 15 to go with it, and a 14 will do. You can see him sort of solving problems, and I suppose you're enjoying the high wire act.
Comic performance is all about that balance between, you don't want to trust somebody entirely, but you do need to know that they'll be able to pull the thing off.
You want to feel a little uncertain
because this is meant... You're laughing because this isn't normal, there's something going wrong, but you do need enough there to make you trust that this is going to work.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I remembered, I hadn't listened to Tom Lehrer for ages before you mentioned that we should do him. So I went back and visited, and I remembered it all being rhymes. I remember that, again, I know what his stock in trade is, the astonishing, bravura, feminine, polysyllabic, internal rhyme. And then I listened to it and thought, there aren't many of these. The capability's there, but they're meted out quite carefully. And a lot of the joke is in the subject matter, or a sort of Charles Adams-y juxtaposition of black humour where it's unexpected. There are a bunch of other tricks going on all the time. I was surprised how delightful the songs were in the gaps between the bravura rhymes. Yeah. There's still loads going on.
Yeah, the other thing is he's a good composer, isn't he? And a lot of his stuff is sort of pastiche of one thing or another, and he does it all very well. But you're never listening to the pastiche. It's not like listening to the Ruttles or Dukes of Stratosphere, where you're going, oh, wow, that's a Pink Floyd one, you know, is it? Yeah. You don't go, oh, this is a musical one.
I double took at the Gilbert and Sullivan that's in the Elements song. At the end of it, I went, oh, that's Gilbert and Sullivan, isn't
it?
I was enjoying it so much, I'd not noticed he'd borrowed someone else's tune.
There's holmium and helium and hafnium and erbium and phosphorus and francium, fluorine and terbium and manganese and mercury and molybdenum and magnesium and dysprosium and scandium and cerium and cesium and lead, praseodymium and platinum, plutonium, palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium and cadmium and calcium and chromium and curium. There's gold and californium and fermium and berkelium and also metallium, einsteinium, nobelium and argon, kryptonium, radon, zinc, nuts, and rhodium and chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium.
I was listening to the Elements again this morning and going, how the fuck did he do it? Yeah. He's got a lyric sheet in front of him, but then I thought, no, he's got a massive brain.
I think it'd be harder with a lyric sheet in front of him.
Yes. It's lovely on the live recording of that where he gets to the end of that first verse, which is just a gigantic list of elements, and in the gap between the verses says to the audience, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
That's again, it's your thing, is that saying he's listening to the audience. There's a gap, there's a moment of silence, and he knows he can get ring one more laugh out of it.
Oh, he's listening to them, he's manipulating, he's making them think he's listening to them, he's getting them to do exactly what he's expecting them to do before pretending to have listened to you.
He's getting them to do maths in base 8.
Yeah.
Oh god, that's
fucking hell.
Jokes in base 8 don't happen often enough. I bet if you went to a robot nightclub, there'd be more jokes in base 8. One of the things that I thought was really interesting, just in terms of the ideas, because it's not just the rhymes and the cleverness and the verbal dexterity, he's clever and he's making you think and he's sticking things together. He said as well, well, the quote I really like, which is, he said that there's something in rhyming that forces you to think differently, that you think of an idea for a song just because two words rhyme. And what he's talking about there is basically surrealism or absurdism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Is you stick to, he said, I wouldn't have written the Wernher von Braun song unless Wernher von Braun had rhymed with down. Yeah. He said, I had to write that song because, and then it makes a moral judgment on the physics and the politics of Wernher von Braun as a Nazi rocket designer who then works for America and they overlook his Nazi past.
Don't say that he's hypocritical. Say rather that he's apolitical. Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun.
And he can write a song about that because of the line, it doesn't matter where they come down. And he said he wouldn't have had that idea unless those two words rhyme. And it's a little bit like rhyming, or the language you're writing in is a way of automatically shaking up the ideas tin, so things stick together. Things are magnetised together that wouldn't otherwise go next to each other. And I love that idea that there's an automated process, like automatic writing, that certain words stick together. And I remember saying this once as a writer for hire when you're selling ideas, and saying that I used to struggle sometimes to get ideas past producers and script editors and things, but the one that would always get past was a pun. That you could argue that the idea wasn't funny. You could argue that if I sort of said there's a Disney film about the Velvet Underground, you might go, well, that's not very funny. But when I say it's called Finding Nico, you can't argue that Nemo and Nico sound like each other. And it sounds like a better idea, even though it's just as bad an idea. And then you rinse every idea out of it and it becomes a sketch. And when someone goes, what a great sketch that was. And you're like, it just was about something that rhymed.
Yeah, that's interesting. I guess rhymes and puns are exactly the same there, aren't they? Just enough to give you the justification to do the...
You can't argue with them.
But I think I think all puns, especially, and rhymes, I guess, are the same thing, and any wordplay, it all has one great meaning, which is look at how ridiculous it is that we're trying to communicate with these fundamentally flawed units. We are doomed. We can never really truly know one another, and it is the word's fault because language is the best that we have. And you say that every single pun you make.
There's something essential in there, which is that the fact they sound the same is distracting. It's like going, oh, shiny. You go, no, the meaning. Yeah, what about the meaning? No, yeah. They sound the same. Now I'm going to go and play with these two words over here. Oh, you've gone.
I wonder if you could start making puns from non-verbal communication. what the equivalent would be. Oh, I guess it's not waving, but drowning. That's a non-verbal pun.
Yeah.
My favourite pun, which I'm just going to chuck in here because we'll quote bits of things until we giggle and blah, 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 is on, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, when Stephen Fry was on and they were doing the announcements for the guests arriving at the Painters and Decorators Ball. And Stephen Fry said, will you welcome that ubiquitous royal libertine, filthy prince everywhere? And it's the fact that he bothered to do the scaffolding at the front of it and stood the thing up.
Set up your joke. There's something great about the music of musical comedy being sticky in your brain. That's a sticky phrase. Ubiquitous royal libertine is a sticky phrase. The words fall well together. And filthy prince everywhere is a lovely sticky phrase. And when you're talking about musical comedy, a lot of it is because the phrases in it are catchy, like a catchphrase. You'll remember them and you'll listen to them again and again, but they'll stick in your head. And talking about, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, one of my favourite comic riffs I've ever seen was a Graham Garden, I assume it's Graham Garden. Someone said recently he thought it was Muir and Norden, but I think it's Graham Garden wrote it for one of the Goodies books, which was the cast list of White Christmas. And someone says, can you write down who was in White Christmas? And a list comes back and it's, I can do this off the top of my head, it's Emma Dreaming, Arthur White, Chris Muss, Jess Likedy, Juan Sui, Hugh Sterno, Wendy Treetops Glisten, Anne Children, Liz Ann, Two Ears Lay Bell, Cindy Snow, Mayor Daisby, Mary Ann Bright, Anne May Hall York Reese, Mrs. B. White. And I can do that having read that when I was six, because the rhythm of it is amazing. Yeah. And all those names sound like the lyrics to White Christmas. But it's sticky in your head in a way that I used to wonder why you'd publish the script book to The Office. I mean, The Office is very, very funny and very well crafted, but it's not in the weight and rhythm of comic prose, 99% of it. It's realistic and recognisable, and it's good character comedy.
I'd say it wasn't... I don't think The Office really is realistic. There was this idea that it was naturalism, when in fact it was very particular new rhythms, which sort of then seeped into everything and spoilt them for a while. Ways of speaking which tricked you into thinking they were naturalistic, when in fact they were just as unnatural as every other bit of comedy writing. It was just a new mode.
Maybe I'm being unfair. There seemed to be a massive difference between that very arch, very Tom Lehrer-y musical way of writing that is Filthy Prince Everywhere and Emma Dreaming Arthur White Christmas as a mode of comic writing, and then something which is where the essence of the comedy seems to be less in the words. But you're right, actually. No, the essence of comedy is in the words, in the rhythms. It always is rhythm. Maybe I'm being a prick.
I don't know. It's something about patterning, I think. It's like it's like an ornate wallpaper or so. There's something more. I mean, not everything has to work in every form. And, you know, if something works well in one form, it's a surprise almost if it works well in another.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it reads well on the page, then that doesn't necessarily mean it reads well out loud. And
that's
vice
a
versa.
Terrifying lesson you learn as a writer.
Yeah, in radio theatre.
Oh God, constantly. But whatever happens, you think you're a good writer, and you go, "Well, I'm a good comic writer." Then I'm sure I give this a good comic performance. They'll be able to do it. And the shocking thing of people, but the number of times that someone will just read something off the page, and you'll go, "Oh my God, the stresses were that you in your head think that rhythm is inherent in
and
the writing."
Yeah, all the time you come across that, and sometimes, of course, there's a better rhythm that you didn't realise was there.
And that's why you realise that people spend ages rehearsing, ideally, except in the real world where there's no time.
I don't even think ideally, though, because there's something about the freshness of the first couple of reads, which you can over-rehearse, and I think over-rehearsing is often actually not that much rehearsing. This might just
more
be
than one.
Yeah.
More than the first time.
I think you need to, I think it's good to get them down early. Certainly, like, when you're performing, you know, if you're doing a play day after day after day, there's a point when everything goes dead and you don't know how it's happened.
Oh, right.
Jokes suddenly stop working and you don't know. You'll do three performances in a row and a joke which used to work all the time. You're obviously doing it differently somehow because they're not laughing. They always used to laugh and you don't know what to do. And the more you think about it, the worse it gets and the more the rhythm slips away.
Is it you losing faith in the joke?
Well, it's this kind of cycle. And I genuinely don't know what happens after that,
won't you? Surely, yeah. That will really throw you.
Normally, you just drop the joke and replace it with something else.
Yeah.
Not in a play. You can't do that in someone else's play.
They get really annoyed.
They're dead. But if they're dead, their estates get annoyed, and their estates get more annoyed than the person would have if the person was alive.
Very protective of the corpse.
Yeah.
Lehrer recorded his first album, which is 22 minutes long, in an hour. He went into a studio.
Wow.
He said, "I've been playing them live in clubs for so long by then that I knew them all perfectly. And I just used take one of most things. Occasionally I'd do another take, but if I did a second take, I insisted that it went over the first take, so there was no editing." So what you're getting when you hear the album is absolutely a performance every time.
How do you feel? I can't... I infinitely prefer listening to the live recordings.
Yes, so do I, yeah.
In fact, it's weird. It sounds so strange to me to listen to the studio ones.
It's odd, isn't it? Yeah. Because the live recordings are... The thing that you pointed out, he's so good with an audience. Mm. He's playing the audience at the same time as he's playing the piano. Mm. It's just beautiful.
You're after a reaction. Again, he's talked about this. He said, if I'm saying something that's supposed to be shocking or get a laugh, you need the sound of people agreeing with you to stop you losing confidence in it. Maybe audience laughter is a very difficult thing. People debate it a lot, but I do like the sound of people laughing.
Oh, it's the truth is, if you don't really notice, if you don't find something funny, that's when you really hear it loudly. That's why people get so angry about it. But if you're finding the thing funny, then you don't notice the audience laughing.
Because it's not your tribe. There's a weird thing with an audience howling with laughter at something. It's a little bit like sitting on a train with football supporters on it, where they all appear to be very excited about something and it gets threatening.
Oh, and an audience, if you're not enjoying... If there's somebody in the audience who doesn't like the comedy happening and everyone else is laughing, it's amazing how they will still... I mean, you see these... somebody wrote about my show last year online. They said in the middle of it, "I love absurdism, but this doesn't make any sense." And I thought, that's enough for me there.
That's going on the poster.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the new show is based around that comment, but they... you can get so angry when the rest of the room is laughing and you're not. And... the way that in that position you will still think, "No, I'm the normal one, I'm right, I don't know who these people are or what they're doing," and you type this thing out saying, "Look, everyone's laughing, but they're not like us, effectively. They're weirdos in there, I don't understand." My friend, years ago, when Jerry Springer, the opera, was on, was in the chorus for that, and apparently, I think I'm remembering this right, the cast all wanted to do a studio recording for the soundtrack, because obviously you get paid more than that, and that's the normal thing.
Yeah. It takes longer.
And Stuart Lee and Richard Thomas didn't want to. They wanted to put out the live recording of the show, of course, because the comedians want the version which has the laughter of an audience on and works in the proper way. Because it's weirdly sterile. It's odd.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even actually Lehrer found this uncomfortable, but the sessions he did with that arranger, whose name I can't remember, and he said he found that really weird to do, because not only then did he not have an audience, he didn't have a piano. He said, so I was standing up to do them, which I'd never done before, and I didn't know what to do with my hands. So I put them in my pockets and did the whole recording standing there, looking very stiff and awkward. And it sort of shows in the recordings. I mean, they're delightful, but nothing beats the live stuff. It's sort of designed for a live environment.
It's not for the live thing. And again, the tiny little beats, even during the fixed rhythm of a song, the amount, I'm sure he's listening to an audience and reacting to an audience, these micro reactions without you even knowing.
Mm.
I love some of the laughs on the live recordings where you don't know why they're there. They're my favourite.
Are they laughing at something in his face?
Yeah,
or a 50s reference, 60s reference that you've
just
missed?
Don't get. Yeah.
Well, there's something in New Math where he does. He talks about bass eight and having if you've only got eight fingers. And then there's a little beat and a laugh. So there's obviously some visual thing in there that you don't get when you hear the recording.
Oh, because I've heard a version of that where he says, if you've cut off your thumbs. So maybe he's miming cutting off your thumbs or something.
Yeah, maybe
that's the lost laugh.
Holding up to... I mean, I'm trying to do it now, and this is a podcast, so that's not going to work.
There's a bit in Fight Fiercely Harvard, too, about raising your glasses. Then there's a huge laugh, and I think, well, that's not... I don't... Why is it? Is this just because... Is this a joke about the drinking culture, or is he doing something? Does he have his glasses on his head?
Oh, he's probably doing that, isn't he?
I have no idea.
But isn't it nice? You talk about the conspiracy of laughter and the tribal nature of laughter, because you're trusting that Tom Lehrer will be funny at that point. You hear the people laughing, and you don't go, they're idiots, suddenly. You go, well, it must be me. I've missed something.
Yeah.
And it's quite a nice feeling. Again, this is my tribe. And I suppose you're still laughing at that, titillating the converted thing. Go, well, I won't not enjoy that joke because these are my people.
Yeah.
He got turned down by several record labels. I think some of them found the Vatican rag a bit inflammatory. And in fact, didn't someone nearly attack him after a performance over the Vatican rag? Someone found it so offensive that they just thought... He said, I'm not taking the piss out of the Pope. I'm taking the piss out of the rituals of Catholicism because they're so covered
Life
in rituals.
Life of Brian Defence.
Life of Brian Defence. There's a letter from Capitol Records to Tom Lehrer that's reproduced in the liner notes to the 3-disc set. I'm going to read it, and I'm going to read the capitals for you. Capital letters, that is. Mr. Tom Lehrer, Box 121, Cambridge 38, Massachusetts. Dear Mr. Lehrer, I'm sorry to inform you that there is no interest in your album of songs.
So-called music.
So-called mathematician. You never hear that, do you?
First you get down on your knees, fiddle with your rosaries, bow your head with great respect and genuflect, genuflect, genuflect. Do whatever steps you want if you have cleared them with the pontiff. Everybody say his own, Kyrie eleison, doing the Vatican rag.
You have often said to me, Jason, obviously we come from a musical background, Jason's a very, very good musician, I'm a musician. You've always said that you struggle with musical comedy as a thing.
I really do because I don't know whether you find this, Luke, but I sort of feel that I can see everything coming. There are so many signposts and big arrows going this way to the punchline, you know, which I don't get any of in Lehrer whatsoever.
Unless
he's put it in deliberately to go, here comes one of these, which he occasionally does.
Actually, that's what tends to be when he does his really stretched puns, when you're waiting for the end of a line. Very often the jokes are in the middle of a line or on the way through, they're passing their grace notes on the way through. When he does head up to a big, cheesy, the rhymes at the end, it's always still a surprise because he's usually going, nothing rhymes with, but if you pronounce it like that. He's quite clever at avoiding the pitfalls of musical comedy.
Do you struggle with it?
I don't like much of it, but then I love some musical comedy. I think there's...
Does it have to be done well?
Yes, as
you're so fussy.
I know, it's weird, isn't it? I think there's types of... Because there's another skill involved with musical comedy, because you've got a guitar, you can play the guitar, you can do these things. It's actually quite an easy entry point. As long as you can play music or make music happen somehow, audiences are willing to put up with you being on stage doing that.
You've earned the right to be there.
Well, yeah, it's very hard to stand on stage and just trust in being funny. And so anything you can have as a kind of, no, but it's fine, I've got this as well. I think improv is the same, that there's this, because you have these kind of rules to play by and you can do this thing. It's a very, very low entry point of being able to follow these rules, do this thing, play this instrument, lets me do this. And audiences are willing to put up with that and willing to sit through it. It doesn't mean there's brilliant examples of both, obviously. But I just think that because it's so easy to get into it, it's a smaller proportion of both, maybe, than the other things.
Yeah.
It's hard to do it well.
I think it's used as a defence. I said the same thing. I've always said, I suppose, what the shadow hanging over you is, you go, is it going to be tum-ti-dum-ti-dum-ti-dum-ti-dum-ti-dum? You sort of think, oh, it's a bit naff. There's always a musical number on a variety show. But I think the funny thing about it is, even when you grow up thinking, this is a bit naff and crap, and this is the bit my mum and dad like, that I'm not, it's not very cool. That when you watched a pastiche of it, like when Not the 9 o'clock News did the two ninnies and took the pee out of the two Ronnies' use of sort of sub-Gilbert and Sullivan rumpty-tumpty-tumpty comedy songs, the parody song they do is absolutely brilliant, and I can remember it word for word. Because oddly, even though I protest that I don't like musical comedy, it sticks in my head, and when it's done really well, it is still brilliant.
We like birds, we're ornithologists, ornithologists. I've got a nice pair of binoculars. You can stick them up on your tripod. We're marching up and down. Spot, spot, cause the sodding choreographers are twat, twat, twat. Couldn't care a jot if we're military men or not. With a bum, how's your father? Honestly, I don't.
I felt I wrote down a list of people I thought were brilliant at it and went, oh God, there's Randy Newman, and there's God, there's the Half Man Half Biscuit, and I started listing them. And I go, I keep saying I don't like it, and I like loads of it.
It's one thing I realised. The probably my favourite bands, or many of my favourite bands, lean towards the comic in their songs. It's also the nice thing about a song which is coming from a band which will play in the comic arena without trying to call themselves without taking themselves down to the level of the comedy song. Like Sparks or They Might Be Giants or things like that, when, oh, there's a great comic premise there, but you don't feel the need to put in a punchline every sentence to force this rhyme to get you to the comic
that's
point.
That's it. It's not forcing yourself into that. Sparks are a good example of that, where Pet Shop Boys, there's sort of dry wit to it, a Divine Comedy. There's a dry wit to it that I suppose, maybe the question is, can you listen to it again and again? Mm-hmm. Because if you can't listen to it again and again, it's failed on the one of the great appeals of music, which is repetition and familiarity. Tom Lehrer said about Monty Python. He was interviewed and said, well, do you enjoy the stuff that's around at the moment? He said, I really like Monty Python. He said, because you can just tell they've really thought about the words they use. There's a comic rhythm in Chris Morris saying, later with Suki Bapswent and her special brand of things, or over to Peter Hanrahan. That's got comic rhythm and beats to it.
That's music, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's a commonality between music and musical comedy that makes it really odd that both, I think all three of us probably at some point have said, I hate comedy songs. Why? Because music has got comedy in it.
I think you've nailed it, though. I think it's about that easy entry level. That's what it is. It's
lazy comedy songs, possibly.
Well, I think it's easy to get to the, oh, this'll do level without then raising it above.
Yeah, boy, oh, this Lehrer as well. I mean, just playing with the actual format and rhythm of the songs as well. So doing something like in the Folk Song Army, the line where he does a line about having too many syllables in it, you know, like Bob Dylan would have done, and make sure that the line has too many syllables in it at the same time, you know.
Strum your frustrations away. Some people may prefer action, but give me a folk song any old day. The tune don't have to be clever, and it don't matter if you put a couple extra syllables into a line. It sounds more ethnic if it ain't good English, and it don't even got a rhyme. Excuse me, rhyme.
It's wonderful.
What you're doing with musical comedy, even more strictly than you're doing with all comedy, which is delivering on expectation, that the audience is waiting for because of rhyme structure and line length. They know where this is going to end, even more than they do when they're listening to just a normal joke. And I think a lot of jokes have got a silent tune behind them anyway. They're Sprachgesang. Maybe the truth is that every other comedian is just Rex Harrison, and they're just singing what's effectively comedy music. But you're playing with the audience expectation. They know where the joke's going to fall, and you either land exactly where they expect and they're delighted, or you miss it and do a backflip and then land somewhere else and they're delighted. You're always playing with expectation. I suppose what Tom Lehrer's doing is doing it in a very skilled way over the top of a tune.
I think something interesting with Flight of the Conchords, who I think are brilliant, who do very, very well. And they changed the rules a bit because Lehrer is all about, I've got this, you know, it's the same as writing a sonnet, I suppose. There's this structure, I need to fit everything into it. I've got this, the song is constructed this way, the jokes need to fit in this song. And Flight of the Conchords then kept breaking that and coming out with the bits which didn't fit anymore, spoken bits in the middle, they'd moved the, changed the verse thing around. Yeah. And it worked brilliantly because I think their dynamic together was so good because they're such a good double act.
Yes.
And then after that, it's rare to see a comedy song, certainly kind of, I'll put that another way, you often see people trying to do it and forcing the jokes in by breaking the rules of the song, and it's very rarely satisfying. Because it's unimpressive, and because you really think, oh, I wanted you to put a bit of work in for me. I wanted, as an audience, to feel like you've really tried.
Yeah.
And it actually feels like you've taken an easy way out.
Maybe the thing with comedy music is that the craft is very visible.
Yeah.
And sometimes when you go and watch someone who is delivering expertly crafted lines in a sketch or a piece of character comedy or a stand-up routine, you pretend to yourself that this is the first time they've said it. And, and then it's a delightful surprise that for some reason the rhythm of that delivery was absolutely perfect. Go and see Eddie Izzard. He looks like he's making it up. Then go and see him another night and you realise he's not really making it up. He's practiced where the ums and ers will fall to hit that rhythm. You've got that. Whereas with a comedy song, all the scaffolding is visible because it's a comic song. So you're kind of, you're watching and celebrating the craft in a more open way. So if someone fails at that craft, you judge them really harshly.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. It all comes back to that making something happen in the room. You've got to feel like you're all in the room together when you're watching comedy, doing comedy. But you'll notice when somebody in the audience starts chatting, it's the hardest heckle to deal with. And you'll hear everyone else in the audience just get quieter and quieter unless the comedian does something about it.
Oh, really?
Because I think people don't know that they've realised this, but what they're realising is, oh, he's not in the same, or she's not in the same, or they're not in the same room as us. They don't know what's going on in this room. They're somewhere else. They're just on stage doing these things because they're not dealing with this problem that we all have. And that's the, for stand-up, kind of conversational stand-up, the way of doing that is to make it feel somehow like you're having a conversation together, which is an amazing skill I don't have. And then it's harder and harder to do the more ornate and crafted you get the thing, because when you're doing this thing on stage, which is obviously finessed and built and all the rest of it, and you what means this has to be here and couldn't work on a film screen or couldn't work written down.
Yeah.
And it's that tiny, I think with Lair, it's that tiny little bit of listening. It's knowing his reactivity to a crowd.
Effectively, what you've got, if you've written a ricky-ticky little perfect piece of jewel-like craft, like a Tom Lehrer song, it could be the equivalent of a backing track. It's he could be on rails. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's what you're feeling with the orchestral stuff. It's too well done. What you want to feel is that it could fall apart at any point.
Yeah.
For that excitement to be there, which is where the kernel of comedy is. And sometimes if you're feeling, you're right, in the room of the audience breathing and listening, and that he might stop or start, people are being attentive. And there's a magic in that attentiveness and his attentiveness to them, which I hadn't even thought about. That you're right. The live performance of a comic song, when Bill Bailey does it or whatever, is so thrilling because it's the opposite of someone singing to a backing track or miming.
I found the same thing with the Python albums, though. When I first, you know, when I watched Flying Circus and that, like the Eric Idle's wonderful Money Programme sketch.
There is nothing quite as wonderful as money,
money, money.
There is nothing like a newly minted pound.
Money, 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 money.
Everyone must hanker for the butchness of a banker. It's accountancy that makes the world go round.
It just goes into a great big song and dance routine, and it's wonderful. And then when you hear the recorded version of it, that's on one of the albums, but there's no audience there, you go, oh, all right, yeah.
Yeah, music is exciting live, so you should hear that.
Yeah.
There's a very funny thing with an audience going quiet or going loud. I remember doing a Mitchell and Webb record for the fourth series, and we were very, very... Everyone in the writing room was very happy with the fourth series of Mitchell and Webb, and David and Rob were delighted with it. And we did one recording where the audience just didn't react to some of the best material we thought we'd written, and we thought, we've got a faithful audience there who like listening to David and Rob, so they'll go with us, and we're going to push some stuff out. And it went dead, and we were in the green room watching it go out, and the audience be very quiet. And I said to Gareth Edwards, the producer, after, I said, Gareth, that was dead. We're going to re-record those sketches next week, aren't we? And he went, no, they're fine. And I said, but no one laughed. He went, they were listening. And I said, well, that'll sound terrible on television, an audience just listening. And he said, you can still sense they're there because they laugh occasionally. He said, when you're at home, you're listening as well. The last thing you're going to want is be deafened by those idiots laughing over the lines. And I went, really? And he said, yeah, that's what his experience was. You need a bit of audience to show there's some air in the room. But if it's deafening, he said he used to take all the laughs out of Bleak Expectations because it started to sound hysterical and it started to push people at home away from that crowd. It felt like a Nuremberg rally. Like, oh my God, I don't want to be in this tribe. And it's the amount of audience, the amount of laughter you need. And sometimes the sound you want from an audience is silence and attentiveness.
Yeah.
And then release. And it's a very delicate balance.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's quite old-fashioned in a way. You know, you listen to old shows which have studio recordings, and so often there are these big quiet patches and they haven't fixed it. And it's much, much nicer to listen to because you realise you don't care.
Yeah,
you're not listening. You're not waiting for that audience to tell you what's funny.
Yeah. Well, you're allowed to listen as well.
Yeah.
At home, you go, well, I don't need this noise. And Gareth said it's a very, very delicate balance of not putting off an audience at home. It's a very hard thing to do, and it leads to... you do want, for a lot of comedy, does need an audience, and the last thing you want to do is pull it out. It's interesting the way that people reacted to the second series of I'm Alan Partridge, where The Office had come out between series one and series two, and people said, why have they put a laugh track and on Alan Partridge? One, yeah. And there was one on series one, and I think I remember watching it and realising they'd mixed it a little bit too high.
Mm-hmm.
And so it sounded, it was probably the same volume as the first series, but it seemed too high. You were used to silence in Comedy of Embarrassment. Mm-hmm. And then when they put the DVD out, they mixed it a couple of dBs quieter, and it's delightful. And it's just as delicate as that. You didn't feel put off by that audience.
A lot of the time you don't remember it. Like, I think I rewatched the League of Gentlemen, not remembering that there was a laugh.
Yes, and loads of studio stuff.
Yeah. Mm. And you can see that actually their performances really benefit from having an audience there.
Yeah, like,
that's the kind of...
Yeah.
But you don't remember it after the fact. I think people... I'm sure people complain about, why have you put this laugh track on this thing? No, it was there.
It was always there. Yeah, I suppose that there was a fashion for saying it was done. It was added to shows that an audience were too stupid to work out where they laugh.
The point of the laughter is for the performance. It's to let the actors know where they're... so they can listen an audience reacting to what they're doing. It's not for the... So putting a laugh... Getting an audience in to see a screening of something, I'm really not convinced that it's pointful.
Yeah.
You know, recording something as if there's an audience there and then playing it to an audience, I think always sounds off one way or another because... It's not having any effect on the actors.
I think we've been to a couple of audience recordings for things where it was done to persuade the executives that the show was funny,
right?
And then was taken off for the actual broadcast. Peter Serafinovich's show was recorded in without a laugh track, and then a laugh track was added. We were in the audience for added laugh track, and then when it was broadcast, the laugh track was taken off. I think it was just to persuade people there were jokes in it because Peter's weird.
Did they do the Christmas specials?
Was I think that had laugh track on there because they kept losing faith in it. Because again, Peter's a good live performer, but he wasn't in any of those sketches reacting to an audience. Mm-hmm. So having people laugh over the top of it just looked... You're right, it looks weird. You can tell it's like Uncanny Valley in animation. It looks too slick. There's something unconvincing and robot-y about dubbing laughter on top of a performance that didn't already have it.
When I dug out my Tom Lehrer albums to have a re-listen for this podcast, I put on That Was the Year That Was. And as soon as it had finished, I put it on again because I fucking loved being in that gig. I loved that gig, and I was at that gig with that audience. Yeah. You know, it's wonderful. It's a really immersive experience.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it does the thing that the peril of comedy songs is that they're clever. And if something's clever, it gets smug. And maybe that's the thing that putting the audience in there takes out, is that you're watching this guy who is a mathematically precise, clever guy showing off his dexterity on the flying piano trapeze, and the audience laughing warms it, and his reaction to the audience warms it, and takes what could be the sterility of a clever performance, takes a bit of the curse off it. Because I imagine there's a way of doing any comic song that makes it unbearable.
I think it's probably true of the offensiveness too, isn't it? That there's this just aspect of community there.
Yeah.
Mm. Takes the edge off somehow.
Well, he said his job was to do comedy, and his idea was that comedy was necessary because comedy kept you sane. So the sound of a community of people reacting to this song makes it sound like that it's performing a community service. It makes it seem necessary and vital. Because he's talking about important things, life and death and not lying and being honest with yourself and your own fragility and things. People laughing with it makes you feel that he's not just showing off that he can make words rhyme.
That's something funny. You know the line, sliding down the razor blade of life? I've remembered that. Like, I remember that being in his patter between songs and almost, I think, started to have an argument with someone about it. Adam Kay, who was doing a show of, who was playing the songs every day, and I was going, no, it's between the songs. And then listening again, oh wow, that's a lyric in the middle of a song. I'd always, because I'd remembered him like saying that in his arch way between a thing, and the audience roaring with laughter before he started another. It's just in the middle of a song, and a song I'm not particularly fond of.
He's only written 37, and you're picking the
I'm
worst
sorry,
ones.
I'm sorry,
or is it 50?
But what an amazing line! Like I think of it almost every day.
I wonder what it would have been like to be at one of his lectures.
God, yeah,
he must have been a dynamite lecturer, mustn't he?
I wonder if people signed up for his course who just wanted him to do the songs, and then turned out to be an awful lot of differential calculus and maths and algebra.
Do you know what his last lecture was about?
No,
infinity. What a dude.
That's vamp to fade, dude. Isn't it?
I bet everyone just didn't want it to end.
That is a great place to leave it, isn't it?
That's perfect. Let's end on infinity. Let's ride off into the sunset on our pianos.
Lovely. No, thank you for
having
me.
Thank you, John Luke Roberts.
Thank you.